integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation. Welcome back to Military Justice. Thank you for joining us. Since the time that the interview in this episode was recorded, there have been some additional real-world developments. It's been reported that President-elect Trump will likely nominate ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson to serve as Secretary of State. Nonetheless, I believe that there is still value in the following discussion. In this episode, I'm again joined by Butch Bracknell, and we discuss two main issues. First is the possible nomination of David Petraeus to serve as Secretary of State. We also discuss the different treatment by the Army of General Petraeus and his biographer, Lieutenant Colonel Paula Broadwell. Now, since the time this interview was recorded, it does seem somewhat less likely that David Petraeus will be nominated to serve as Secretary of State. But I believe the discussion still holds true, even if Mr. Petraeus is nominated for some different cabinet position. So before we get to the debate, I've got a few audio clips to kind of set the stage. One is from Senator Paul being asked about the nomination of General Petraeus. And the first clip is President-elect Trump during his campaign speech talking about Secretary Clinton and the issues with mishandling of classified information. Thank you again, and I hope you enjoy this.
When Hillary Clinton runs, and she should be in jail, by the way, for what she did, just so you understand. No, she should be. She should be. You know, it's really sad. It's a sad, it's a corrupt system. Everybody knows she should be in jail. What she did with the emails is a disgrace. People that did 5% of what she did, their lives have been destroyed. Their lives have been ruined. Their lives have been ruined. You look at General Petraeus, nice guy, had some bad moments, right? Nice guy. What happened? They destroyed him. They've destroyed other people for doing far less than Hillary. I don't think they're going to do anything to her. That's my opinion. I don't think they're going to do anything. I think she's going to run. She's being protected. She's being protected 100%. And you know what? It's not right. You know, it's almost not right to all of the other people that have suffered so greatly. That's if you really want to know the truth. It's not right. But, so let's assume it's, and you know, one way I'd rather run against her than anybody else I can think of, if you want to know the truth. But at the same time, it is not fair because she shouldn't be allowed to run and a lot of things should happen to her.
Think you could support former UN Ambassador John Bolton? What about retired General Petraeus?
You know, I think the problem they're going to have if they put him forward is there's a lot of similarities to Hillary Clinton as far as revealing classified information. One, is that a good thing to have a high-ranking person reveal classified information? And also the similarities. I mean, they spent a year and a half beating up Hillary Clinton over revealing classified information, and then they would appoint somebody who the FBI says not only revealed it, but then lied about it in an interview and purposely gave it to someone who did not have the clearance to have that. I think that's a potential problem. But I think
he pleaded guilty to that charge.
And pleaded guilty to it. I think part of the guilty plea, though, has to do with holding higher office. I'm not a lawyer, but I think if you look at the statute on there, there may be a provision that says you may or may not be able to hold higher
office.
There's
also a provision that says the President of the United States can grant security clearances basically to anyone he wants.
Yeah, there's going to be some questions asked, I think, if that were the conclusion.
Welcome back, everybody. We have Butch Bracknell as our guest today, and we will be discussing General David Petraeus and his possible selection as Secretary of State. Hello, Butch.
Hello, James.
How are you today?
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking.
Well, I just wanted to make sure. I'm going to give a little bit of overview of the Petraeus scandal, or at least relevant parts of it. Feel free to augment or contradict as you see fit, and then we'll get down to the discussion.
You know I will.
Yes. So General Petraeus, I think it's fair to say, has had an extraordinarily successful career in the Army, almost unmatched. He was known for the 2007 surge in Iraq. He commanded at every level. His final command in the Army was with International Security Forces Afghanistan from July of 2010 to 2011. And I believe it was in 2006 when General Petraeus first met Paula Broadwell at HAVID, where you were likely lurking around, probably also at some skull and bones type secret meeting with the two of them.
In 2006, no, I had bailed out by then. You would have only found me in a brew pub.
Yeah, but you probably still have that secret habit in a com that just alerts you of any important meetings going on. So Broadwell, I think it's fair to say, was also a very successful Army officer, definitely a fast mover. She had gone to West Point and I believe also Harvard. And she eventually becomes the general's biographer.
Correct.
For a now kind of inappropriately titled biography, All In, The Education of David Petraeus.
Seriously, you can't make that up, can you?
All In, yes. So Broadwell's also a, I believe, a major lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserves when she accompanies General Petraeus at ISAF in Afghanistan.
Yep.
He retires right after he gets back from Afghanistan in July or thereabouts, 2011, is unanimously approved to head the CIA, and he takes over that position in, I believe, September of 2011.
That sounds about right.
Then in May of 2012, things start to unravel. Jill Kelly, a socialite down in Tampa who volunteered a lot for CENTCOM and was...
How do you get that title anyway? Socialite.
So socialite, I think it's self-applied.
Yeah.
Listeners, don't let Butch fool you. He is also a socialite.
I am. It's such an archaic word. You know?
So she files a complaint with the FBI because Jill Kelly is getting kind of anonymous or fake email threats about stay away from my man, I believe. Mm-hmm. And she files a complaint with the FBI, and the lead investigator is Special Agent Frederick Humphreys, who actually was on my prosecution down in Guantanamo Bay.
Is that right? Did you know that guy?
Yeah, he was a great, great guy. Very tenacious, had been a former Army Ranger, great, incredible FBI agent, had also, I think, not too long before this scandal, had shot a guy at the gate to CENTCOM. Someone was trying to run the gate, and Humphreys had to shoot him.
It
was,
man.
Yeah, I mean, it was justified, no problems with it, but a weird deal. And that supposedly inappropriate picture of Humphreys with his shirt off was also prominently displayed in our offices when we were doing the Gitmo trial. I think it was portrayed in the media as he was, you know, in a state of undress. The guy is a total stud triathlete. And you know those martial arts dummies?
Yeah.
He looks identical to those martial arts dummies.
Yeah, so, I've seen the photo. Yes. I've seen the photo. He looks like a live version. He's
right.
Got his arms around these other two dummies, and he looks exactly like them.
Being another bald man, I'm sure you're in cahoots with him.
I'm partial to it.
Yes. So it turns out that Broadwell was the one sending these harassing emails to Kelly. Mm-hmm. We have a fairly protracted investigation of all this. Also, General John Allen was brought into this at the same time. He had been exchanging a number of emails with Jill Kelly, socialite. As a result, General Allen removed his name from being, I guess he would have been your boss there at NATO.
Secure in Europe.
So during this investigation, it was found that Petraeus and Broadwell were using now kind of an antiquated way of doing this, but they both had the password to an email account, for example, a Yahoo account, and they would leave draft versions of emails as a way to communicate so both of them could see the drafts.
Tradecraft, man.
Yes, that was something that was useful in maybe 2003. So November 2012, Petraeus resigns from the CIA, citing this extramarital affair. April 2015, Petraeus pleads guilty in federal court to mishandling classified information by providing it to Broadwell.
A misdemeanor charge, which is noteworthy in our analysis.
Absolutely. And now the most recent news as of December of 2016, it seems that both General Petraeus is in the running, or maybe even the front contender, to be Secretary of State in the Trump White House, and the Army is now taking some sort of disciplinary action against Paula Broadwell.
It has been described as disciplinary action, but as I suspect that our discussion will reveal, it may be something else.
Some sort of administrative or disciplinary action,
yeah,
lower than a court, because yes, it's, at least from the latest reports, it's been protected by the Army under the Privacy Act.
Yes.
So I think we have two major subjects to debate today. One is, for the military justice portion, is the possible disparity in treatment between General Petraeus and Lieutenant Colonel Broadwell, mm-hmm, and the appropriateness of General Petraeus possibly being the Secretary of State.
Shall we start on the first prong of this two-pronged analysis here, the propriety of Broadwell being cut a husk here? So as we know, DOJ did not go after Miss Broadwell or Major Broadwell, Lieutenant Colonel Broadwell, whatever we're going to call her. Let's just call her Broadwell from here on out. DOJ did not go after her in a Article 3 type court, leaving any action that was going to be taken against her to the Department of the Army as an Army Reserve officer. And that analysis, as I understand it from media reports and talking to some folks in DOJ, was fairly hotly debated and pretty hotly contested. And she basically got a pass because of her status as a journalist. It was a policy call not to go after her. If they had the evidence to make a charge against Petraeus, they might have had the evidence to also make a charge against her. So she had a clearance, but had no access and was knowingly receiving information for which she had no access.
And probably, you know, improperly storing it also.
Improperly handling it, improperly storing it, probably improperly transporting it, the whole nine yards. So really, she got cut a husk there because of a policy call, probably not because of a lack of evidence or the inability to make out a charge. It was assuming they could make out a charge. As a matter of policy, we're not going to go after her because that is the policy of this administration under this attorney general, was not to go after journalists in similar circumstances. And so then there's the argument, was she really a journalist? So she's writing a book. Does that make her a journalist in the same way that David Sanger at the New York Times is a journalist? He's a credentialed journalist. He does that for a profession. That's what he does for a living. She was more like a policy professional / academic. But the DOJ, I guess, looked at all the factors of what makes a journalist and decided that she had more journalistic factors in her favor than those which cut against her, and gave her the break and interpreted that category liberally and brought her in under the rubric of journalist and decided not to pursue a case against her. So, you know, that explains part of the disparity in treatment. It was really just a policy call.
What was the policy call by the Army?
So the Army, to the best of my knowledge, did nothing with her heretofore. So I do not believe none of the offenses for which she would have been found guilty occurred while she was in a period of active duty. So there would have been no court-martial jurisdiction, I don't believe, for any offense. So then you don't have non-judicial punishment type authority either, which would leave the Army's remedies against her merely administrative, to pull her security clearance, not as a punitive action, but because she's committed an offense against the security system, right? She retained information she wasn't entitled to have and probably transported it unlawfully and probably stored it unlawfully. And so that's kind of a normal outcome, right? When a person commits an offense with regard, that kind of offense with regard to the classified information system, is to get your clearance pulled, either temporarily or permanently, or leaving it to you to have to file an application to have it restored, because whatever concerns there were about your trustworthiness with classified information have been mitigated over time or retraining or whatever. The recent media reports this week that the Army is doing something with Paula Broadwell, but we don't know what, and we're left sort of to guess. And so the best guess is, if they didn't have criminal jurisdiction over then, they don't have it now, and it certainly probably didn't get better with time, right? We're 2 years on, 3 years on, really 4 years on from the corpus of the offense. So they probably don't, if they didn't have enough to take her to non-judicial punishment or to a court martial 4 years ago, they don't have it now. So the question is, what is the Army doing? They're probably doing an administrative separation. We can't know that because those kinds of things are protected. The Department of the Army has interpreted the Privacy Act to protect that information in this case. So they're deciding not to be more forthcoming about what it is actually they're doing. If this were in the Marine Corps, if this were the same circumstance, you and I both know, it would probably wind up with her with some sort of administrative separation. Either she has rights to a board of inquiry or some sort of more curtailed separation where maybe they're not pursuing an other than honorable discharge. They might have a more streamlined process to getting her out of the Army if they think that that's the right outcome.
Now, I think that this is one of those examples of the Privacy Act being used more of as a sword than a shield, because we know all the underlying actions of everything that's occurred here. You know, it's not like her privacy is being protected, but now we're left to wonder, is the Army holding her accountable for, is part of the underlying basis her extramarital affair? And if so, why did the Army choose not to pursue that type of charge against Petraeus? And why did the Army not choose to take any administrative action against Petraeus? I mean, he's still subject to the UCMJ and still subject to a reduction in rank.
Yeah. Okay. So you just teed up a bunch of different issues, and I have a bunch of different
thoughts. That's what I do.
Yeah. So let's talk about the reduction in rank first. I published a piece at Lawfare blog that you can take a look at. It when the Army was contemplating, or when DOD was contemplating this issue of reducing Petraeus' retirement grade. If you Google Lawfare blog, the case against Petraeus.
I'll put that in the show notes also and tweet it out.
And I sort of lay out the reason why I don't think that grade reduction in his case was appropriate. The bottom line is, if you look at the entire body of his service as a four-star, even if you consider this to be an egregious violation of security regulations, that argument that it's egregious is undercut by the fact that he wound up pleading out to a misdemeanor. But if you look at it at that against 6 years of service as a four-star, in which he essentially spent almost all 6 years of it overseas in some really weighty 7 days a week, very difficult jobs at MNCI and as commander at CENTCOM and as a commander at ISAF, they kept calling the guy's number and he kept answering the bell. I mean, what more do you want from a man in service of his nation? Yeah, this last little thing, it wasn't good.
He did bring along a little bit of comfort during one of those tours.
Fair. I think the comfort met him there, but the point. Okay, and as long as you're going to use the term comfort in that regard, let's compare his experience to that of general officers and flag officers in the Pacific Theater during World War II. It just ain't that far off from the standard that was set years and years and years ago. I mean, look at MacArthur. It's well documented.
Right.
Look at George Patton. It's well documented. Even Eisenhower. It's well documented. So I'm not really prepared to hold that against him when you compare it against the historical record. But I kind of lay out what I think is a pretty good case, and which decision that the Secretary of Defense ultimately adopted to go ahead and allow him to remain retired as a four-star, which is a significant difference in the amount of pension that he receives every year, not to mention status. So if General Petraeus becomes Lieutenant General retired Petraeus, he just doesn't have the same gravitas. He doesn't have the same je ne sais quoi that you would have if you wanted. I mean, being a general is a big deal. It's different. As I've often said to anybody who's wanted to hear, there's junior varsity generals and then there's varsity generals. The junior varsity generals, with due respect, are the one stars and two stars. They're mostly generals in training. But when you get to three star and four star, now that's the level within an armed force where they are really taking significant decisions. One stars and two stars generally just don't have that much of significant decision power, unless it's executing like a capital case as a convening authority. That's a big deal. But in terms of spending money, running programs, and making decisions about the way a service is going to run, that's retained at the 3- and 4-star level. So there's a big jump between 1- and 2-stars and 3- and 4-stars. And then there's another big jump between 3-stars and 4-stars. 4-stars are historic figures. 3-stars, with rare exception, are less so. You know, every now and then you get a Brent Scowcroft, or in this case, a Michael Flynn. But most of the time, lieutenant generals just sort of retire into obscurity, into relative obscurity relative to their 4-star. You know, their 4-star contemporaries just become national level figures, where 3-stars just don't really make that transcendent leap.
If he's not reduced in rank and doesn't have a pay cut there, what detriment did he suffer as a result of all of this? What did that misdemeanor do?
So he had a $100,000 fine, not insignificant for a misdemeanor charge, right? I mean, that is a substantial fine. The judge looked at
which is the same as his speaking fee right now.
Probably, yeah, right. But at the end of the day, it's still $100,000, and it exceeded what the prosecution asked for, and I believe it exceeded what the probation officer in the pre-sentencing report had asked for as well. The judge imposed that one. $100,000. I don't care how much money you make. That's a smack. That's a smack in the kisser. Let's say he was making $600,000 or $700,000 a year. You take 1/6 of my income for the year in a misdemeanor plea, and I'm hurting. That hurts me. So let's not treat that $100,000 fine like it was nothing. I mean, that's $100,000, James. That's a pretty significant penalty for a misdemeanor, plus the probation, plus just the stigma of having a conviction on his record. This was not the case of the century, right? This was, in the grand scheme of things, there was no evidence of any disclosure to a foreign power. There was no evidence of any attempt to disclose information to a foreign power. The information was handed to an officer who did have a clearance but did not have access. So he handed the information to a person who has at least met some criteria, some indicia of reliability with handling classified information. Granted, it was wrong. It was against the law because she didn't have access. She didn't have the need to know, really, in sort of, you know, layman's parlance. She didn't have reason to be receiving that information. She wasn't authorized to receive the information, but she was probably a reliable holder of that information nonetheless. You know what I'm saying? The risk posed to the United States by this disclosure was pretty low. This was really about sending the bell throughout the rest of government about how this administration, which has prosecuted leakers and folks disclosing classified information at a rate far in excess of any of their predecessors, Democrat or Republican. So this was just one other case of they had to kind of do something because it was out there for everyone to see. And this case was pretty publicly visible. People were going to know. People in the FBI who knew about this investigation, if nothing had happened, would have leaked it. So it was going to come out one way or the other.
So do you think the Army could have taken criminal action against Petraeus?
So they retain criminal jurisdiction over retirees in retirement. That's not even debatable. The barrier that you have to go through, and it's kind of a self-imposed barrier, to get Secretary of the Army permission to bring somebody back on active duty. You can't bring them back on active duty for an administrative action like a non-judicial punishment. So if they had brought him back on active duty, it would have been to bring him for a trial by a court-martial. But he had already answered for those charges in the Article 3 system.
I mean before the Article 3 system, because there's no reason that the Army had to defer to the Article 3 system.
There is not. But in those cases, at some high level, DOJ and DOD are talking about it, and DOD is saying, hey, one of us is going to take the lead on this. And I suspect DOJ said, hey, he's retired. We got it. I mean, and it would have really broke.
And I suspect they also probably say something along the lines of, there really isn't the ability to conduct a trial against a 4-star. In paneling a jury for that may be impossible.
A little bit of a flaw in the design of the system, right? I mean, what senior officers do you select for a panel? You need at least 5 4-star senior in rank. So you'd have to go to the other 4 services to find any, if you could. I don't know. With his data rank as a 4-star, you might have had to impanel junior 4-stars, which would be okay because
think of the functioning of our military. I mean, you would have to have at least a dozen 4-stars all pulled to one base to kind of sit around for voir dire.
Right. In order to get 5, you'd probably have to start with 10 or 12. That's right. And so you take 10 4-stars out of circulation. It's just kind of impractical. The system doesn't envision trying general officers.
Right.
The system envisioned trying lance corporals gunnery sergeants, and captains. It does not envision trying general officers, really, with the exception of Jeff Sinclair, of course. But as I noted, he was a JV general. He was a one-star. So out of an Army officer corps of probably 400 or 500 generals, it wasn't hard to find a panel. You could reach around and find enough two-stars whose jobs could afford their absence for a few weeks to get that case done.
Yeah, and we had the same just recently occur with General Hoss Cartwright of the Marine Corps. I mean, he pled guilty in federal court because, I don't believe there's any possibility practically of the Department of Defense handling those cases.
To a felony count, you might note as well. I mean, Department of Justice took a pretty different route with regard to Hoss Cartwright than they did with General Petraeus. Part of that may have been the sensitivity of the thing that he was talking about. A lot of the stuff that was written down in those notebooks that General Petraeus handed over to Paula Broadwell it's classified, it's important, it poses national security risk if that stuff is leaked. When you talk about Stuxnet, you have entered a completely different realm of classified. I mean, this is talking about a core strategic capability here. It was a big deal to be talking about that.
Right, because some of Petraeus' classified information is also going to be time sensitive. The time has passed.
Right.
You know,
right.
We've already executed those missions. So by statute, they remain classified, but it's already happened, you know?
Yeah, let's not poo-poo that too much. There were the names of some agents in there who were undercover that were in some code words and some things like that that might have still been damaging to national security. There might have been some names of some folks in there who were still in place in country whose, if their name was just publicly disclosed, might have put those people in jeopardy. So let's not downplay it too much.
Let's take a break for 1 second to clear something up. Both of us are speaking in our individual capacity.
We
don't know this through any contact with that information. We're only going from media reports.
Never seen it. Just everything I've read and folks that I've talked to in unclassified forums.
Yes.
That's exactly right.
Okay,
and I am speaking in my personal capacity to you as a quasi-academic, not as as an employee of any organization.
So go on, please.
Where were we? So why didn't DOD bring him back? I mean, we've plowed that ground a little bit. It's impractical. It's really hard to do. Did DOD or DOJ have a bigger interest in prosecuting him? Probably after he left active duty, DOJ's interest grows big, particularly, in fact, in light of the fact that his job at the time that this was being investigated was as a CIA director. That's kind of where we are on that. It's just impractical, and DOJ's interest was bigger than the military's.
I think we've covered this. Let's move on to the appropriateness of David Petraeus as Secretary of State.
Yeah, okay.
You want to go first.
Thanks. I'm over this whole thing. I mean, he went to court. He pled guilty. He took his fine. He's been on probation ever since. He suffered the indignity of the prosecution. At the end of the day, Dave Petraeus has still got a lot to offer our nation. He is still a really accomplished and experienced and bright officer, or now civilian. He still has service to give. And like many of those general officers, if asked, will serve. The answer among those guys is almost always yes. Not always. I mean, Jack Keane just said no thank you to SecDef. But with Joe Mattis, for example, if asked, will serve, because they operate under this assumption, which I think is a valid assumption. If the nation, if an invitation comes to me to serve as a public servant, who am I to say no? I can understand why General Keane might have said no in this case, if he was in fact asked, as the media has reported, and he said no. He's getting older. He might be just too much for him to sustain. But when General Mattis said, I can do it, therefore I will do it. In this case, if someone goes to Petraeus and says, will you be the Secretary of State, I believe he'll probably say yes, because these guys are really serving. I really believe, without being a sycophant, I do believe that they have a core. Their internal core is about servant leadership. And so he believes that his nation needs his steady hand at state right now, and that he can do good for the nation. Then he will probably accept the appointment if offered.
I think
there's some other things on the table here as well.
I'm just going to fill in the audience, because they can't see you, and I can see you over Skype, and you're wearing, it appears, two Make America Great Again hats. So I'd like to address the apparent problems with now President-elect Trump stating, actually I'm joking about those hats, President-elect Trump stating on a myriad occasions that Secretary Clinton was unfit to serve because of her mishandling of classified information, and how you can reconcile that with the possible nomination of Petraeus.
Well, to me, that's kind of easy to reconcile. Number one, if Senator or Secretary Clinton did break the law, if the facts were provable in court that she committed criminal offenses, which we have the FBI director never actually said that she did, none of her conduct added up to a criminal offense, but he used the no reasonable prosecutor standard, that there are other factors that even if the evidence could possibly sustain a conviction, there are other reasons not to bring the case. And let's be clear, that's not an unusual outcome. I mean, U.S. attorneys decline cases all the time. They've got a limited amount of resources. They need to put their resources towards cases that actually do public good, and that they can actually afford to bring where they have a reasonable likelihood of getting a conviction. In the FBI director's judgment, no reasonable prosecutor would bring that case 10 times out of 10.
And Trump disagreed with that analysis.
Well, he did on the campaign trail, yeah. Of course, because he knew it was deeply, deeply popular with his base and with folks he was trying to bring to his camp to say that that was the wrong decision, to say that the FBI director was wrong and that he'd been co-opted and all that stuff. He has since backed away from that post-November 8th, or what was election day? Yeah, November 8th. And he's since backed away from that. And then every now and then somebody, one of his representatives will bring it back out again. But he has not embracing that notion with as much enthusiasm as he did on the campaign trail. So you're asking about how we can square those two things. She was never tried and convicted. She was never charged. She was never indicted. Petraeus was. So to me, he's paid the piper. He's even with society now. Or he would be even with society after his probation period has run. That's the penalty to the judicial system said, this is appropriate. Under the sentencing guidelines, the judge said, we believe this is the appropriate penalty, and he paid the fine, and he suffered the indignity of the
But he's still on
conviction.
Probation. Correct?
He's still on probation. That's right.
So, as a probie, he would be nominated to Secretary of State.
Yeah. So, I mean, all he has to do is let his probation officer know where he's going to go to work. This is Dave Petraeus. I'm going to Washington. I got a job. You know. And they would transfer his case from wherever he pled, in Charlotte, to the Western District of North Carolina, probably to the Eastern District of Virginia or the District of D.C. or wherever he would be living. That's not that unusual. Or the president could commute his sentence and say, that's enough with the probation. And with the stroke of a pen, he can make that go away the day after inauguration.
This issue crosses over both administrations. His continued ability to hold a security clearance. It was even a week, I mean, days after his plea, he was again briefing the president. So it seems that this never amounted to a problem with a security clearance.
Yeah, so I don't know whether his clearance was suspended or not. Let's assume for a moment that it was. Assume for a moment that it was suspended. I mean, the president is the original classification authority, right? The entire security clearance, I keep hearing this all the time about when they were talking about Secretary Clinton on the campaign trail, you hear people say, how can she be president? She can't hold a security clearance. Listen, the entire security clearance process is a creature of statute, but primarily it's a creature of an executive order.
Oh, yeah. I believe it's almost exclusively an executive order.
Yeah. The entire classification system relies on it. Yeah. So the president, it's the president's executive order. Of course he can create an exception for the Secretary of State to get his clearance back. All he has to do, I mean, with a stroke of a pen, he can say, under my authority, you know, under the executive order, it's 12, the number escapes me right now, it's 12483 or something. I need to go look it up. But with a stroke of a pen, he can make that happen. He is the original classification authority. All the classified information in the entire U.S. government, not just on DOD, but within Department of Energy, Department of State, Department of Homeland Security, anybody that classifies information, it's all on his authority. So he can create whatever exception he wants to. Like, so with Secretary Clinton, had she been elected, there is no security clearance problem. She is the security clearance. Everybody else's is dependent on her. In this case, everybody else's is dependent on President-elect Trump. So the minute that he takes, I mean, he has all the authority in the world to grant an exception to restore. He can restore his security clearance with the stroke of a pen. This is just not even an issue.
I agree with that.
I hear a lot of talk about that.
It's not an
issue. How will the adjudicators look at this? They'll never see it. He'll take it away from them and say, this is happening.
My retort to that would be, yes, I mean, it's absolutely, it can happen. My retort would be that it's inappropriate for it to happen. And at baseline, what troubles me and makes me come to the conclusion that Petraeus should never serve as Secretary of State is not really the criminal action, but the part, and it's in his plea colloquy, where he admits, quote, in response to those questions, defendant David Howell Petraeus stated that A, he had never provided any classified information to his biographer, and B, he had never facilitated the provision of classified information to his biographer, unquote. Mm-hmm. These statements were false.
Yes.
That's my biggest issue with him ever serving, or especially not, obviously he can serve in many roles, you know, have in the private sector, in voluntary organizations, but when the cards are down, he lied.
I got it.
I think it would change my mind completely if he would have invoked his right to remain silent.
It is problematic that he did not. It would have been better that he did. But surely you're not unfamiliar with the really old legal doctrine, which is not really in play anymore, of the exculpatory no. For the longest time, the courts recognized almost a right. It's in the context of being charged under 18 U.S.C. 1001 on false statements. For when a investigator asks you, did you rob the bank? And you say, no, that wasn't me. That the courts almost expect people to deny culpability, and that denying culpability being a natural reaction to being confronted with evidence of crime, it can't form the basis of a 1001 charge. Now, that
believe
doctrine,
me, I've lived it. I was ordered to go be interviewed by NCIS, and stared
exactly
at them and said, lawyer, you know, that was the only statement I would make.
Right. No, exactly. And so in that circumstance, you did the right thing. Under the old system, under the old exculpatory no doctrine, you could have gone and submitted to the interview and denied wrongdoing that they had otherwise had evidence of the fact that you had done. And under the exculpatory no doctrine, you couldn't be charged under 18 U.S.C. 1001 for that. That law has since changed. But my point is, there is some sort of a social expectation that when the police come and ask you something, it is not an unreasonable reaction to say, no, I didn't do that. I got it. It's wrong. I got it. He made a false statement to the FBI. I'll bet you if you asked General Petraeus right now, if you had that to do over again, how would that turn out? He would say, I would either invoke my right to remain silent, or I would have just come clean with the truth. Now, hindsight being 20/20, of course you would have come clean with the truth because we would have known you was coming out anyway. Is that a really major, compared with what he can offer, compared with his relationships throughout the Middle East, which are not insignificant? I mean, let's assume he knows every minister of defense in the entire Middle East by name. Let's assume he knows virtually every minister of defense in the entire European theater by name by virtue of his service at ISAF and having to meet with those folks, you know, in various NATO conferences on updates about operational updates to the ministers. Let's assume he has relationships with all the ministers of foreign affairs. And let's just assume he's a really, really studied scholar in international affairs and would know how to do that job at least as well as any of the other nominees currently being considered. Are we really willing to sacrifice that kind of capability and that kind of service over something for which, in my view, he's now even Steven with society over? I take your point. He didn't have to lie about it. I also know that if the cops came busting into my door right now and asked me about a bunch of offenses, my first reaction would be to say, no, twern't me. You know what I mean? I mean, I think when you look at it on balance, the guy's still got a lot to offer us.
I don't disagree with his ability to offer things, but I would just question forever his if he's, you know, making reports to the Senate and he's questioned about sensitive issues, does he revert to that, no, I didn't do it, that release valve that is lying? I mean, we're supposed to be above that. I mean, he wants the gravitas of being a general and an officer in the army, and that honor is held in high esteem. He's not, he's lost that. I mean, now he's a politician.
Yeah. He's lost that, but the question is, has he lost it forever, or is it possible to recover that over time? And has he done enough to recover that over time? You expect when you discipline one of your children for lying to you that then they take that on board, and then they say the next time they have the temptation to lie to you about something, that they say, no,
which
that
you
was
have
wrong.
56-year-old children.
That's a fair point.
He's time-traveling, everyone.
This is a very, very smart guy. I mean, we have to assume that he learned something from that whole affair. No pun intended. We have to assume that given the same circumstances, that he might not immediately revert back to non-truthful mode. Now, here, there's a thing here. You just raised the issue, and I thought about this one before. When he does testify, let's say he's appointed as Secretary of State, and he's confirmed. Later on, he has to come in and he testify before the Senate on some issue. You know, he has to testify for his annual appropriation or whatever. He has to come in and testify about some issue. He is now open to some senator on the other side of the aisle questioning him and saying, well, why should we believe you now, Mr. Secretary? You lied before. Why should we believe you? And that's an ugly thing for the secretary to have to swallow. He needs to understand that if he takes that, he is open to that criticism in future hearings. That he basically can, from a sharp guy on the other side of the aisle who wants to take him down a peg, he has opened to that line of cross-examination.
And I've already heard it from the Republican side of the aisle.
Sure. Sure. I mean, the way that a cop lies, if he gets caught lying one time, he's essentially no good as a cop witness anymore, right?
Right.
Because he's forever impeachable. Isn't it true that in the case of the state of Maryland versus Jones, you actually told the court this, but it was actually a lie? Isn't that true? Yes, that was true. Once you're burned as a witness for forever. So he would have to suffer the same kind of indignity in future testimony. Is that enough for the administration to say, yeah, I'm not touching this because we don't want to see that show 2 years from now when he's, you know, sitting before the Senate Foreign Services Committee, the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee? I don't know. It's a potential liability.
I'm going to give you the last word. Say whatever you will, Butch.
Yeah. So there's other things out there for me, for General Petraeus. Let's say, there's no shortage of candidates that have been, whose names have been tossed around for this position, right? Tulsi Gabbard's name, Mitt Romney. You keep hearing, and now I heard Admiral Stavridis this past week. Corker, Senator Corker.
Oh, what a writer Stavridis is.
He is a good writer. He is a good writer. And he'd be a pretty good Secretary of State for many of the same reasons that Petraeus would, with less baggage. A little baggage, but less baggage.
Yeah, a tiny little
A tiny little bit of baggage, but less baggage. And for those who are interested in what the baggage is, Google Stavridis, Stavridis, Dodig, and you'll find it for yourself.
And follow him on Twitter. He's actually a great tweeter.
He's good, but there's a little bit of drama that follows him, but it isn't a misdemeanor charge of mishandling classified information. That was kind of a big deal. If there's no place for him on the cabinet, the president-elect could do worse than to think about him for a big ambassadorship. Who would be a better candidate to be the U.S. ambassador to Iraq than General Dave Petraeus?
Right.
I mean, I'm trying to think. I was trying to think of alternate candidates who would be better positioned. I don't know if he, Saudi Arabia, but a big diplomatic, someone we have to have a big diplomatic presence with. We need to make a splash with the appointment. He doesn't have any particular expertise in Turkey, I don't think, but it's a position that he could certainly fill. He's certainly not unfamiliar with the issues with Turkey on the northern border of Iraq and on the border of Syria. He could make a splash. I mean, I think he'd be limited to the European theater or to the Middle East. I don't think he'd be a very particularly effective U.S. ambassador to Brazil, for example. But if you started to look over past the Horn of Africa and north and east a little bit, you could find some jobs there that are big enough to fit Dave Petraeus. You're not going to appoint him, with due respect, you're not going to appoint him to be the U.S. ambassador to Montenegro, right? That's probably going to be a career diplomat. But if you're trying to make a splash with a big appointment and somebody who has instant credibility, probably with the Iraqis, you could do worse than to make him the U.S. ambassador. He knows the ground. He knows the issues. There's legacy issues there that go way back. He has institutional memory. He knows a ton of the players. Even though some of the players have changed, some of the players remain the same. You know, and so major generals that used to be division commanders are probably now advanced in the Iraqi army. You could do worse than to think about him for a big ambassadorship. Absolutely. Another one that I was thinking of is the U.S. ambassador to NATO. Right now, it's Doug Lute, who used to be the Iraq war czar, right, or the war czar in President Obama's cabinet. And then he got, or rather, as a special assistant to the president. And he moved over to be the U.S. ambassador to NATO, assuming that the next president is going to replace him. that might be a place that General Petraeus could be really, really effective for the United States. My bottom line on all this is he's got service left to offer. We'd be kind of crazy to look past his capabilities, and we just need to keep the liabilities out there in perspective. Mishandling of classified information is a serious deal, but again, you have to stack it up against the body of work. And does this really present real continued risk for us? I think the risk is pretty mitigated.
Well, I will be announcing who won this debate after you're off the line, so the listeners can wait for that.
It's always you.
Well, thank you for being on today. It's fantastic as always, and I will put that article up that you wrote for Lawfare, and as always, Butch Bracknell on Twitter. I'll give you out your website that has all of your writings, and the listeners couldn't be better served than to be reading what you're writing.
Groovy, man.
Have a great day.
Thanks for having me on.
Out.
Cheers.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that discussion with Butch Bracknell. All the ballots have been tallied. All the chads that were hanging have been counted. And unfortunately, Bracknell came in number 3 in that debate. He's actually improving. He came in 4th place last time we debated. But you gotta admit, he did a valiant effort that time. Welcome to iTunes Reviews. If you like what we've been doing here at Military Justice, we would be eternally grateful if you would go to iTunes and leave a review of the podcast. If you do leave a review, it might just be read here on the show. For example, True Crime Marley 16, quote, "I give MJ 5 stars. It's one of a kind, completely original. If you are a fan of Undisclosed, then you must be a justice seeker. This podcast is also about justice, but with a different set of laws," unquote. Thank you, True Crime Marley 16. As I've mentioned before, I don't just read the good reviews. So, here's another review. Quote, "This podcast has such potential and falls dismally short. The host adopts a degrading, abusive tone and talks down to the listener," unquote. I don't think I do that, but you listeners wouldn't even understand it if I did. These reviews are important. They help new listeners find Military Justice on iTunes, and new listeners equals Military Justice being around a little longer. Please go to iTunes and leave a review, good, bad, or ugly. I'll read them here on the air. And I thank you again for leaving reviews, and I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I've got to thank everybody who's behind making Military Justice. First, executive producer Dennis Robinson. You can find his Twitter handle in the show notes for this episode. Next, the lovely and talented Brooke Giddings. She does all of the audio for this podcast, and I really couldn't even attempt to put this podcast together without her. And finally, there's my Uber producer, Dreadnought. He's always got my back. Wyrick out.